It's All Things Bugs today. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our next guest will be appearing Sunday, August 23rd at Honest Dog Books up in Bayfield. I just wanted to introduce you like that because it sounded like, I don't know, a late-night TV host or something, because we've got a celebrity with us today. The manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, PJ Leash, is here to answer all your bug questions, help you ID those bizarre bugs. If you want to send us a picture, you can send it to talk@WPR.org. You can also give us a call and ask your bug questions today at 1-800-642-1234. That's talk@WPR.org or 1-800-642-1234. What sort of infestations are you seeing where you are across Wisconsin and beyond? PJ, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Lee.
So you had the Wisconsin Insect Fest recently at Old Brick Gardens. You've been at La Crosse recently. You're going up to Bayfield next. What are you seeing around the state as far as bugs are concerned?
Anything and everything. I mean, it's peak insect season. My workload at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, I mean, it's a bell curve centered around July. Last month, I had over 500 identification requests, so that's often 20. Sometimes a busy day will be 30 a day.
Oh.
Sometimes it takes me longer to respond back in terms of what it is. Other times, I have specimens I have to prepare microscope slides, and that can take a couple hours, or sometimes you have to wait overnight for things to clear and get just right so you can see it better, and that can be a multi-day process even.
What's the most bizarre unboxing you've had at the diagnostic lab recently?
Oh, well, a really interesting case from up in Green Bay area. It was on a farm, and individuals that were handling hay and other materials, they were experiencing a lot of severe skin irritation.
Ooh.
And I had a few ideas for what could be going on. I asked for a hay sample, thinking there might be something in there. There's a creature called a straw itch mite, Pyomodes. And I checked the hay, and it was clean. Didn't see any evidence of it in there. And then was chatting with the folks, and they mentioned the feed. And I said, well, get me a sample of the feed. So they dropped off all these tubs of various animal feed for livestock and such like that. And we're talking about mites that are under a millimeter long, incredibly small. So I'm looking through there and I find the smoking gun. So we figured out what was going on. And the solution in a case like that is to get rid of the infested grain. The mites are really feeding on insects that are present, feeding on the grain-based feed. But the insects were in there. I found some too. And so easiest thing was take the infested stuff, get rid of it, get some new feed for the animals.
What kind of mites were they?
Oh, Pyomodes. It was the itch mite.
Okay, it was the itch mite.
They can sometimes be in hay. Sometimes they can be in stored products. I've had one case, they were actually in dog food. It was an older bag at a shelter where insects were infesting it. The mites were in there too. And I mean, the skin irritation from those mites is severe. I've never experienced it myself, but just the pictures, the descriptions of it, not a pleasant situation. So that was one of my kind of weirder cases recently, but
yeah.
I'm really glad we found that smoking gun. We got it figured out in that situation.
Well, it's weird in that I usually picture when it comes to the diagnostic lab getting a little envelope with a little bug in it, but you're getting hay in there, you're getting buckets of feed coming through your lab.
A few years back, I had someone, they had a big interior scape planting. They literally brought in an entire banana leaf, you know, about 4 feet long. So I get that sometimes. And then I also do get, you know, just the paper envelope.
Yeah.
Ideally, I like to have folks pad things a little bit, you know, put it in a little Tupperware.
So it doesn't get crushed and end up in a million bits. It would be hard to identify a million bits.
Yep.
Because they're going to dry up in there.
They will, yeah. And over time, you know, I can piece the ants back together and usually figure out what they are. But yeah, a little bit of padding protection goes a long way for insect samples.
Now I've got this picture of you putting this puzzle piece together made up of 50 little parts of an ant. I am seeing a lot of carpenter ants around my place. Is that a concern of mine?
Well, potentially. I mean, with carpenter ants, they can have large, long-lived colonies. And often when we see carpenter ants, just human instinct, the first thing we want to do is squish them. And I often tell folks, hold off, watch them for a while. Because especially if they're indoors, they'll follow edges of countertops and walls and things like that, baseboards. And if you spend some time watching them, you can get a better idea of, well, where are they going to? Are they wandering in from outdoors because they're going to a food source that's in here? Or are they going somewhere else? And often if they're coming from different directions, you can almost triangulate, you know, a hotspot, an area where you should focus your attention. You got to do some detective work. There are cases where if you follow them enough, you might figure out, oh, they're actually coming from that rotting log or that stump out in my yard, and they're just sneaking in. If that's the case, you could potentially address it out there, and that would be an end of the situation. There's other cases where they could be in structures if there's some, you know, water damage. Wood, sometimes in structures, they'll actually get into the pink or blue foam board insulation that's under siding. Because if you think of the density of that stuff, it's very similar to rotten wood.
Oh, interesting.
So they get in there and they're not feeding on it. They don't get nutrition. They're tunneling through it, excavating it to make chambers to live in. So that could be a possibility too. So my best piece of advice is watch where they are, where they're going to, try and figure out what they're up to.
Well, they appear to be going into the exterior of my stucco home. So
okay.
I feel like it might be a need to probably put out some baits and seem reluctant there.
There are baits for carpenter ants, but the ones that you find at the hardware store usually don't work the best for carpenter ants. So each ant species has slightly different preferences in the things they like to feed on.
Yeah.
Some like sugar, some likes more fat or protein. You, by all means, you could try a couple. They're usually not terribly expensive and see if they go to it. There are more professional-grade products that you can purchase online through various vendors that are geared more specifically for carpenter ants. They've been formulated just right. We know they're more attractive to those ants. One thing about baits with carpenter ants, and this is documented in the literature, sometimes it can be a very long process if you have a large colony, like on the order of sometimes 8 to 10 to 12 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And so folks don't realize this is a 3-4 month effort. Now, if it's a small colony, it could go much faster than that.
But that takes us all the way to winter.
Well, right, exactly. There are also, there are sprays that can be used. Carpenter ants can be a little bit more challenging than some of our other ants in and around structures. And so one consideration can also be to chat with a pest management professional. Mm-hmm. The reason I say it is they have some products that would be much harder for you or I to find. They've got the products, the ingredients, the formulations that are just right. And they have some products that are considered non-repellent. If you use a repellent product and the ants touch it, they might get irritated and take the long route around to avoid contacting the surface.
Sure.
But the non-repellent products, they'll walk across it. They don't know it's there. And it can almost work like a bait in that regard because they pick up the tiny particles of it.
Right.
They bring it back to the nest. So the pest control folks have a couple of kind of gold standard products that they use for carpenter ants.
I told you before we went on the air that I was at the state fair last week, PJ. What I didn't tell you is I ate bugs.
What'd you have?
I had a grasshopper and some ants.
Okay.
Jane Jerky, I believe, had a stand out there that was one of the Sporky finalists. And so I had to give it a try. And, it was protein. Do you think less of me now for having eaten some bugs? I know you're a bug guy.
Yeah. So I've tried a number of insects over the years. A lot of them are... You have your chocolate chip cookie with a dried mealworm on it.
Okay.
That's your
little
like
protein
entry
your
level.
Snack.
You don't even really notice the flavor. A couple years ago, my wife and I went to D.C., visited one of her friends, and went to a high-end Mexican restaurant, probably the priciest one I've ever been to. It was darn good food, and I had a chapulinas taco. Those are the grasshoppers.
Oh.
It was really good. And then when we did Wisconsin Insect Fest at Olbert Gardens a couple weeks back, we had a couple of food trucks that they had their usual stuff, but they had some edible insect dishes. So I got to try some silkworm pupae and some giant crickets. And they were actually quite good. I enjoyed those.
Silkworm pupae?
Yeah.
How do you doctor that up in a way that would be considered edible?
I mean, those were in dumplings, if I remember correctly, and the giant crickets were fried. So if you can imagine like a really deep fried shrimp,
You put a little salt on it, and you can deep fry anything.
You can.
I just wondered if you would, you know, sort of bristle at the thought with your love of bugs that I'm out here at the state fair trying bugs as a protein.
Not at all. I mean, worldwide, so many cultures around the globe eat insects as a regular or somewhat regular part of their diet.
Yeah.
It's more of, in the U.S. and in Western culture, it's not as much of a thing. From a sustainability standpoint, you know, it's a lot less labor intensive. You need a lot fewer resources to produce like a pound of grasshoppers compared to a pound of beef or something like that. So there's folks out there researching that, looking into it as ways from the sustainability standpoint, maybe not necessarily for human food, but for, could we raise insects to feed to chickens or something like that, make it more sustainable as a whole. And especially if you could find an insect like black soldier flies that maybe could help break down the chicken manure or waste byproducts. So there's some really cool things that are being researched at the moment.
Well, and you mentioned grasshoppers. We were talking about trout fishing last week, and our guest said it's grasshopper season, that this is a perfect time to use grasshopper as bait, or potentially deep fry it with a little bit of salt, and you're fine with that too. Why are grasshoppers more common this time of year? Is this just because that's the time of year for insects, really?
Yeah, so in the state, we actually have dozens and dozens of species of grasshoppers, and most of these overwinter as eggs down in the soil. And so they spend the winter there, and it makes sense. You're below ground, you're more sheltered from temperature extremes and things like that. Especially if there's snow, you're buffered pretty well. They hatch out in spring, so we get our juveniles. They reach maturity right around now, latter half of summer and into the fall. And so this is the time of the year that they're more conspicuous.
And we've got all these different varieties. You can tell them apart, but could I?
There are some guidebooks out there that are pretty good. There's some good resources as well. For grasshoppers, that is a group, personally, I don't work as much with compared to other groups. So even I have to sit there with a field guide and look at some of the coloration. Sometimes you have to look at the tip of the abdomen, some of the reproductive structures to be able to separate the species as well.
And can they be damaging to crops? Are they a concern in Wisconsin with their population?
For Wisconsin, not so much.
Okay.
It's interesting, though, if you go out west, drier locations, key thing about grasshoppers, they usually fare best when you have dry conditions. So you go out to parts of Montana, Wyoming, and so on, grasshoppers can be a huge agricultural threat out there to crops. Wisconsin, if we had a couple of consecutive really dry years, I would expect their populations to build up and maybe we start seeing more plant damage. Otherwise, in my mind, are they out there nibbling on plants? Yeah, but usually the damage is pretty minimal. I will say there's a really cool book called Locust, which is about the Rocky Mountain locust. This was a grasshopper it's now extinct, but in the 1800s, had a swarm about the size of the state of California called Albert Swarm, and it ate kind of everything in the central U.S. People starved to death because of that grasshopper. They ate so much. They'd land and they'd start like chewing on tool handles and things like that.
It was literally a plague of locusts.
Yes, exactly.
Oh my, where did they go? How did they become extinct?
They would go through these population cycles. It turns out humans tried to eradicate them and that didn't work. It was more of an accidental eradication. I don't want to spill the beans on it because it's a really cool book. It's called Locust by Jeff Lockwood, I believe is the author's name.
I am fascinated by it. PJ Leash, our guest, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. It is his busy time of year, but he's taken an hour for us today. So if you have questions, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have pictures of bugs you'd like ID'd, you can send us them our way at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Irene emailed us and she wants you to talk mosquito dunks versus pesticide sprays. Do they work?
Oh, it really depends on what you're trying to accomplish. Mosquito dunks are these little briquettes, look like a piece of charcoal almost, or sometimes there's granular formulations. Those are things that are put into water where the larvae of mosquitoes develop. And what's nice about those is the ingredient in there, it's a type of naturally occurring bacterium that happens to be toxic to insects, and even then very specific insects. So in this case, that ingredient, it's not something that works against like beetles and butterflies. It's specific to the larvae of true flies, the order Diptera. So that's mosquitoes, and if there were other aquatic fly larvae in there, they could be impacted, but it's very narrow spectrum, relatively speaking. So that can be an option. You have to understand that we've got about 55 species of mosquitoes in the state. Mm. There's a lot of differences amongst them, and some are basically homebodies. They come out of water they developed in, and they stay relatively close. And so if you knew your local mosquito population is some of those, then the dunks might help more. We have other species, though, that are capable of flying 5-10 plus miles. And so you could, in theory, nuke everything in your yard. But if more are flying in from 10 miles down the road, it overwhelms whatever you're doing, either the dunks or the sprays. Mm-hmm. So with the sprays, those work best if you know you're having an outdoor event, a wedding, a graduation party, something like that, and you want to temporarily knock their numbers down. The typical mosquito yard sprays, though, a lot of them contain very broad spectrum ingredients.
Yeah.
And so that can impact all sorts of things, butterflies, bees, and so on. And if you are having your yard, the vegetation yard, sprayed on a monthly basis throughout the entire warmer months, that's going to be really bad for all sorts of beneficial insects.
Thank you for the email, Irene. And by the way, Vicky in Lake Mills emailed us. She says when she traveled to Mexico with the Olbrich staff last year to see the monarchs, she tried fried grasshoppers several times. She thought they were good. Others in the group had no desire to try them. Don't knock it till you tried it.
I agree with that.
Thank you, Vicky. We'll go to Jim in Stevens Point next. Jim, hi.
Good morning. I just have a general question. Why do some insects only like certain plants? For example, I was visiting my daughter in Minneapolis, and she had a lot of spotted bee balm, and it was covered with black wasps, and that's the only place that we saw them.
I mean, if you think about all the plants that are out there, they each differ in terms of the shape and structure of the flowers, the color of the flowers. You also have to keep in mind that insect vision is different than ours. They don't see very well in the red range of wavelengths. They see a little bit more shifted towards the blue end of the spectrum. And so sometimes there's flowers to us that might just look white and yellow, but to insects seeing UV light, it might have like a bullseye pattern on it. So there are these kind of invisible things that are out there that might be, it might be like the plant kind of yelling to the insects, hey, come here. So there can be some visual things like that. There might be differences between the species in terms of what resources they are looking for, you know, nectar of a certain composition. So that very well could be at play as well. We do know, generally speaking, sometimes you have insects that are kind of broad generalists and they go to maybe a range of flowers. And then sometimes we have other ones that are picky eaters. They're going to like one type of plant, one plant genus or plant family, for example.
When it comes to survival, though, wouldn't a general eater probably fare better than one who's picky? I would think that Darwinism would suggest that the general eater would fare better in the long run than somebody who's looking for a specific meal.
Well, potentially, and there's a lot we could potentially unpack there. If you are a generalist, you know, you might be nibbling on this plant here, and the plant has certain defensive chemical compounds and things like that. And then if you go to this other plant here, it might have different chemical defenses. And so physiologically, are you able to withstand both of those? Mm. And if you're a broad generalist that feeds on hundreds of different plants, you know, you're having to deal with all sorts of things. And so it could make sense, yeah, if you can feed on lots of things, theoretically, that might help you out. But there's also some challenges there potentially. And then we have plenty of things that they do just fine with specialization. You know, maybe they're only feeding on milkweeds, but they're really good at detoxifying the stuff that's in milkweeds. And that could actually help them if they incorporate those toxins, then they are protected. So it's not a clear cut in terms of if one is better than the other.
That makes a lot of sense. And I was thinking about Vicky talking about going to Mexico with the Olbrich staff to see the monarchs and the milkweed that they rely on for the most part. You also mentioned dry conditions, PJ, and it made me think of the spongy moth because WPR had this news article last week about how, what is it, our oak trees are looking pretty rough right now this summer in Wisconsin. Part of the reason is the drought. Part of the reason is the spongy moth. But part of the reason the spongy moth is doing as well as it is because of the drought.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, and gosh, I feel for oak trees. I mean, oak trees can certainly be majestic trees to have in your woods or in your yard, and we've got all sorts of challenges with them, oak wilt disease and various spots in the state and so on. But also the drought itself can be hard on the trees. The drought, dry conditions can favor insects like the spongy moth. Luckily, at the moment, spongy moth isn't too bad compared to what it was if we go back about 2, 3, 4 years. Mm-hmm. Because from about 2022 to 2024, we had a major outbreak of that in the state. We set the record for numbers of acres defoliated in a single year from spongy moth. It was like 300 some thousand acres, I want to say. Huge chunks of forested areas defoliated. Now, another thing that can happen, though, is we're getting kind of death by, you know, a bunch of paper cuts here, mm-hmm. because you got a tree that's stressed from drought, maybe gets defoliated by gypsy moth. Then there's these kind of opportunistic things that can pop up, these secondary issues. Maybe that's diseases from the insect realm. There's one that I bump into, and I have seen an increase in samples of these I've had the last 5 or so years, which is called two-line chestnut borer. And this is basically a native, very close relative of emerald ash borer. They have the same body shape. They're actually members of the same genus of beetles. So close cousins, if you will. If you have a happy and healthy oak tree, yeah. two-line chestnut borer just tends to fly right on by. They're not interested. They're looking for the ones that are running ragged and stressed. Then they get in, and they'll start causing some dieback, some thinning of the branches in the upper canopy, and that can work its way down over the course of a couple years. So there's a lot of different things that are going after oak trees these days.
The WPR news article I read about the spongy moth said that part of the reason they do better in drought conditions is because the fungus that kills them is looking for wet conditions, and they're not likely to be found in some of the drought-stricken areas this summer.
Right, right, yeah. The dry conditions suppress some of those diseases. And it makes sense intuitively. If we have damp food out in our house, it gets moldy compared to the dry stuff. Same kind of thing happens with some of these fungal pathogens. They're encouraged by damp conditions. When we were experiencing the outbreak, 2022, 2023, 2024, in 2024, we finally hit some rainy weather in like May and June. That's what helped turn the tide. In 2023, if I remember correctly, we had a dry stretch right in that critical window, and then it was rainy after that, I believe. And so it was a matter of getting the rain at the right time when the caterpillars are out and active. And in 2024, that happened. We had the fungal disease pop up. Also, due to their high populations and crowding, there was a virus that popped up too. So they were getting sick left and right with two diseases. I took pictures that year from the Driftless area where there's trees coated with hundreds or thousands of dead caterpillars. And visually, you could tell apart how they died based on how they were hanging on the trees. Turns out the ones killed by the virus hang down in a V shape. The ones killed by the fungus would basically hang kind of straight down. So you could look at it and say, that one died from virus, this one died from a fungus.
Where are they in their life cycle right now, PJ? I got about a minute.
Yeah, so at this point in their life cycle, the adults in southern Wisconsin would have been active a little while ago, laid eggs. Those eggs will sit there until next spring. If you're in far northern Wisconsin, there may still be some adults out there, but we're getting later in the season. So adults, they'd lay eggs, the eggs over winter, and then we get the caterpillars come spring.
PJ Leisch, our guest, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And Jim, we'll get to your question in just a second. If you have a question for our guest, you can call 1-800-642-1234. Or if you have a photograph of an insect you'd like diagnosed or identified, send it to talk@wpr.org. And we've got a dragonfly that we need to ID, and we'll do that when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. It's bug season in Wisconsin, and our guest is entomologist P.J. Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Lee Rayburn, and if you have questions for him that he can help answer, you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can send a picture to talk at WPR.org, and we'll get to the photo in a moment. But first, let's go to Jim in Fort Atkinson today. Hi, Jim.
Well, I'm a senior citizen, so in 1969, I worked at a gas station, and at that time, everyone who came in to get gas had to wash their windshield off because of the bugs. Now, recently, there are no bugs on my windshield.
Well, now, yeah.
Yeah, so this is something that entomologists have really been observing and trying to document for quite some time. And we actually have a name for what the caller just described of the windshield effect, where we are simply noticing fewer insects. And exactly as the caller described, you know, everyone would have to come in and squeegee their windshield off because there were so many bugs stuck to it. And we're not seeing that nearly as much anymore. It still happens sometimes. As a whole, there are definitely concerns about insect declines, both in the U.S. and North America, but really globally. It's a hard topic to study, though. And there have actually been research projects on this just to figure out, like, how long do you need to monitor insects in a given spot to figure out if they're going up or down? Because there's so much variation from year to year, based
sure.
on weather and things like that. And you have to look at insects for long periods of time. It's not 1 or 2 years. It's 15, 20, 30 years to pick out some of these trends. And that makes it challenging to research them, have the consistent studies done to get funding for things like that. It's a challenge. But as a whole, we definitely have this building body of evidence that there are insect declines going on. And the challenging part with the declines is there's not one single cause. And I make the analogy, if we knew there was one cause, you know, in theory, we go to that switch and we flip it in the other direction and it fixes the issue, but that's not the case. Some folks have referred to it as death by a thousand paper cuts. It's mm-hmm. all these interacting factors. It's things like agricultural practices, changing climate and weather patterns, weather extremes, things like drought.
Loss of habitat. We always
loss
hear
habitat.
That.
Yeah. So there's all these interacting factors, and it's hard to tease out. And it could be a case where in one geographic location, there's factor A is most important, and in another location, factor B might be more locally important. So it's a very challenging thing to study, but we are experiencing these insect declines, which is going to have impacts for the ecosystem as a whole, but also to humans. We rely on insects for things like pollination services,
mm-hmm.
for crops. And so this is something that it's a big issue, and folks are really taking a close look at it these days.
And I would imagine part of the struggle here is the insect kingdom is just the biggest one by far, right? There are just so many insects, so many different types of insects. Its population is almost seemingly incalculable. And then when you're talking about population decline for an incalculable population, that seems like scientifically would be almost impossible.
Right, right.
But anecdotally, it seems obvious.
Right. You have this dichotomy of that. It seems very obvious when you look at things like the windshields. For insects as a whole, we know of over a million described species. But there is a paper I saw recently came up with a newer estimate for how many are yet to be described that we don't formally know of. And there's probably millions more out there. So it's hard to know what's going on with populations if we haven't even discovered and described some of these things.
But when we've talked about fireflies in the past, we've talked about how cyclical those can be and how dependent the environment is on how that population is. And I was thrilled to see them lighting up in my neighborhood again this summer, where they've been gone in summers past. But the windshield effect, as Jim describes it, going back to 1969, that's more than 50 years ago now, that seems to be a common occurrence, more common occurrence, regardless of where you are.
Right, Right. And again, a lot of factors can play into that. I mean, one big thing that comes to mind when you think about some of the agricultural practices that have changed over time with the invention of things like Roundup Ready crops, where you can be a farmer and it's slick technology when you think about it. You can go in, you can have your crop, which can tolerate the herbicide, but it takes out all the weeds. Well, sometimes those other weedy plants could have been food or resources to insects. And when you look at, you know, the sheer number of acres where we've had agricultural changes over the last 50, 60, 70 years, that's a big impact. We know things like light pollution can have impacts as well. There's been some studies out of the UK that look specifically at like moth and caterpillar populations near streetlights. And if you go to another location where it's much darker, you tend to have more of them. So lights can throw up behavior. Again, it's kind of death by a thousand paper cuts. All these little things adding up to result in these insect declines.
And then in the food cycle that we rely on at the very, you know, one of the, towards the bottom there are these insects, and it's just going to filter its way up, I would imagine, potentially eventually. But it's our food cycle that may be playing a role in it with our crops.
Yeah, and I mean, when I think of kind of ecology and the ecosystem as a whole, you know, one thing we also hear challenges with would be, you know, bird populations. And it turns out our songbirds, when they're feeding their young, they're feeding on things like caterpillars and other insects. So these things are all interlinked when you think about it.
Jim, thank you for the call and certainly some deep thoughts and bigger picture and questions about where we're going and how we're going to get there. All right, we've got a picture to ID here. I can tell it's a dragonfly, but I can't go beyond that. Elizabeth emailed us a picture of a beautiful dragonfly. This is in her Columbia County garden just yesterday. PJ, what do you see? I see black with some blue dots, a little yellow up atop towards the head maybe.
Yeah, so this is a member of our family Echinidae. We call the darners commonly. And there's a bunch of species out there. Some can be very common, perhaps our commonest dragonfly in the state, or at least one of them is the green darner, which is actually a migratory species.
There's no green in this guy.
This isn't that particular species, but that's a very common member of that family. This is one of the other species, and to be honest, I'd have to pull out some of my dragonfly books to compare some things to narrow down and definitively confirm the exact species, but it's a member of that darner group. A lot of these do have this kind of very beautiful mottled black and blue pattern on the abdomen, some stripes that are bluish or greenish or yellowish up on the thorax. Many of these can be very common species, and some can be strong flyers and travel a good distance away from water too.
Huh, they're very beautiful. Elizabeth, thank you for the picture of the darner dragonfly. Terry called, couldn't stay with us. She has a bunch of young ash trees. PJ, should she just kill them now to prevent them from becoming destroyed by the ash borer? Boy, this is a tough question to handle.
Yeah, that is a tough question.
Because I've heard it's sort of an inevitability right now with the way the ash borer is, but at the same time, you kind of want to have hope.
Yeah, I would say it would depend a little bit on the particular situation. It's unfortunate Terry wasn't able to stick around so we could chat about it. I mean, one question would be, where are you located in the state? Emerald ash borer is not everywhere yet. It's in most of the state. It's technically been found in all 72 Wisconsin counties, but there's areas of north central, northwestern Wisconsin where the presence and impacts are relatively limited at this point, and it might be some time before it finally gets to your particular neck of the woods. Also, are the trees in a yard? How many of them total are there? If you have small numbers of ash trees that are currently in good health, they're not too big, there are some treatment options for those to maintain their health, versus if this is a woodlot situation or a forest situation, you just have dozens, hundreds, thousands of ash trees, we really don't have a good management approach for something like that. So would be happy to chat more about this, Terry, if you want to shoot me an email or something, would be more than happy to discuss your particular situation.
John wants to know, what's the best way to get rid of cloth/carpet moths?
Okay, so clothing moths, we have two species that can be pretty common. key thing about these is they really don't like to be out in the open. If you gave them the choice, they would prefer a dark, tucked away location. They can feed on natural fibers like wool, but if you have, say, a wool rug in your dining room or living room and it gets regular foot traffic and vacuuming, that's usually not going to be a great spot for them out in the bright room like that, versus if you had a rolled up wool, you know, Persian rug that's mm-hmm. in a closet or a basement that has been sitting there for 5-10 years, that's what they like to go to. So in terms of your house, things to look at would be wool items. They can also go to silk and furs and things like that. I've had them on taxidermy mounts on occasion, feeding on the fur.
Sure.
It's a natural protein-rich fiber. So that can happen on occasion. If you have pets in the house, you know, we've had black labs for a long time, and you end up with pet hair here and there. And maybe once a year, you got to do a very thorough cleaning, get under the edges of baseboards with an old credit card or something like that. Get that out, because those sorts of things can be potential food source. If you haven't had it done in a while, check your ductwork. If there's pet hair and things in there, that could be a tucked away food source for things like that. Ideally, if we can go around and do detective work and figure out what they're feeding on and deal with that, that will help eliminate the issue. There technically are these pheromone traps you can get. Those don't eliminate the problem, though, and people often think that they do. Mm-hmm. That's more of an indicator. So I would suggest maybe putting those in different rooms. That can help identify a hotspot. If you see one in this bedroom, one in another bedroom, and there's 100 of them in the living room, you know, that would tell me, okay, the source is probably close by. And so then you can kind of hone in and do your detective work and hopefully figure out the source for them. If you look at items like a wool scarf, you know, fur coat or something like that, it looks good, no damage. If you take that and you put it in like a big Rubbermaid tub that seals up well, or a bag, something like that, that'll help prevent damage too.
Yeah, that makes sense. And John, thank you for the question. Have a horror story for you here, PJ, from Jim in Mauston, who was eating breakfast outside, swished away some bees that he then realized were wasps. A wasp was hiding on the backside of his sausage link. He bit into it, and it stung him on the upper lip. He says he can handle pain, but this one made him cry. And he just wants to remind everybody, keep your eye on your fork before it goes into your mouth.
Yeah, well, I am sorry to hear about that. That would not be a pleasant situation. I've been stung by yellow jackets, you know, quite a few times. With yellow jackets and paper wasps and our other social wasps, and the same general concept applies to things like bumblebees. These insects, they overwinter as new fertilized queens. So the colonies naturally die out in the fall, mm-hmm. but the colony produces a batch of new queens. They mate, they go find a hollow log or some other sheltered spot to hunker down. In spring, those queens come out of essentially hibernation. They are trying to establish new nests, and it's a mad dash to do that. Most of them are going to fail. If they all succeeded, we would have wasp nests all over the place. So most of them fail. But the ones that do start a nest, that queen starts raising a workforce, and that workforce is reaching peak size right about now. Mm-hmm. That's why this time of the year we see so many wasps. They also, being peak size, they have the maximum number of mouths to feed back in the nest.
Sure.
So they are out there foraging all the time, looking for food to bring back to their young. And specifically those larvae back in the nest, they need protein for growth and development. So
sausage?
Exactly. That's why, you know, they would probably go more to a sausage than maybe a pancake or something like that. But golly, ouch, on the lip. That does not sound pleasant.
Jane emailed about 2 weeks ago. She came upon two bald-faced hornet's nests on the wilder part of her 2 acres just south of Sun Prairie. She's avoiding the areas near them for now, but was wondering about what to do with them in the future. One's a small birch tree that she has a fence around, but she usually clears out the weeds around it from time to time.
Okay. What I would suggest in this case is, because those are kind of in a back corner of places, if you can simply give them some space and let them be until those colonies die out naturally in the fall,
okay,
then you can just prune those out, and there's no sting risk for that once the colony has died off. So if you wait into, you know, probably sometime in October, if we have a late fall, into November, but they are going to be starving to death because their food sources dry up as fall comes. And also once we get some hard frost, that takes them out as well.
Nature's going to take its course on this.
Exactly. So if you can simply wait it out and, you know, if you can leave the weeds for the time being, that would be the simplest course of action.
PJ Leisha, our guest from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And let's go back to the phones where Ken in Mayville standing by. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I was up in the Waupaca area about mid-July. And just wondering if there's an increase in tick populations or not. I ran off into the woods for a quick second to check some mushroom spots that I know, and it was being lazy. I didn't spray or anything. And then over the course of like the next 4 days, I pulled 15 ticks off of me, all in the larval stage. I couldn't see them until I took a picture and increased, you know, with my phone, and I like zoomed in. I'm like, yep, there's legs on that little brown spot.
That's another horror story, PJ. Just went out to the forest for a few minutes, and Waupaca comes back, and he's got 15 ticks that he finds over the next 4 days.
Yeah. I mean, in general, ticks are something that are an emerging health threat for us in the state. Mm. And we have 15 to 20-ish species of ticks. Some of those are highly specialized, and you would never encounter them unless you went looking for them. Like maybe it's a tick species that only feeds on rabbits. And unless you're hunting rabbits or your dog gets one, you'll just never see that species. But most of the time, we're bumping into what we call the wood tick or American dog tick. That's probably our commonest overall. And then the black-legged tick, also known as the deer tick. And that's the one we have the most concern with because of Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, babesiosis, Powassan virus, and some other things as well. Now, what's interesting to me, and often folks may not realize this, we didn't find our first deer tick in Wisconsin until the late 1960s. I think there was a paper published.
Crazy.
Right. So to go from that, and that was a few locations in northwestern Wisconsin, fast forward 50 or so years, and they can basically be found in any county in the state.
Yeah.
Now, still the northwestern kind of half or so of the state, we probably bump into more there, but this is an emerging health threat just in our lifetimes. You know, over the last several decades, they have been pushing into new areas, basically colonizing new areas. There was some recent research, and we know the rate of infectivity, i.e. the percentage of ticks carrying Lyme, it's about 50% or even greater in some locations. So that's definitely scary news.
We had veterinarian Bill Stork on a couple weeks ago. He talked about having tick infestations among dogs outside in February.
Yeah, and my wife's a small animal vet, and so I do hear of this sometimes that folks are saying, oh, it's December, you know, my dog doesn't need the flea and tick treatment. Well, you can bump into ticks any month of the year if it's warm enough, and if you let your guard down, you know, these diseases can be risks for humans. They can be risks for pets as well. So I've heard of ticks. Actually, last year, one of my last cases at my lab for 2025 and one of the first ones for 2026 were ticks.
Wow. So it's kind of year-round at this point.
Almost, and especially, you know, if it's cold, we got snow on the ground, unlikely you're going to bump into ticks. But we get that warm spell. Maybe it's 50 degrees in January.
They start coming up.
Right. You say, oh, it's, you know, mid-January, I'm going out for a hike or a walk. You could bump into ticks out there.
Kathleen in Indiana emailed us a picture. She saw this amazing spider web last week. It is beautiful, and it made her wonder if she could identify the spider by the type of web it spins. Oh, this feels like a trivia question, PJ. Is that the case? Would she see other webs like this one from the same spider species?
Yeah, so in this case, this is your kind of classic, you know, spider web, the round
circles.
Yeah, the spokes of like a bike wheel going out.
Yep.
And many of our orb weaver spiders, there's the family Araneidae, they make webs that look like this. Can be very, very common. We actually have a whole bunch of different species. So in this case, I'd have to see the actual spider to tell you exactly what species it was. But as a whole, that family, the orb weaver group, they make the webs like this. And if you're familiar, most folks, you know, have read at one point or another, the children's book, Charlotte's Web,
yeah,
was based on one of these orb weaver spiders.
It really is a beautiful web, and I have come, thanks in part to you, PJ, to really love and appreciate the spiders around my place. They're doing good work.
They are, definitely.
I am grateful for them. Well, okay, well, I feel like we really are testing your mettle here, PJ, because Dave emailed us a picture. It's a blob, but... It is a blob that has legs and was walking on a picnic table. And Dave wonders what planet it is from. It's hard to describe. It looks like, I don't know, like not necessarily a blob. It looks like a bunch of sawdust maybe that's black and white kind of.
Yeah, it's a little debris pile. It turns out there are larvae of certain lacewings that are known to be debris carrying species. And what they will do is they will grab bits of debris, they use their mouth parts and basically shove it over their head onto their backside. And then later on, they'll maybe pick up something else and just keep pushing things back. Sometimes it might be the prey insects they fed on. So this is like very Halloweenish. You know, if you're walking around with the corpses of your prey on your back, that's pretty horrifying. But if you were to see these with your naked eye, you would just see this little bit of debris walking. If you were to grab that very carefully and flip it over, you would see the six legs under there. And then their mouth parts are these basically hollow fangs. They can impale prey like aphids, and that's how they feed on them. But yeah, almost certainly one of those debris-carrying lacewings in this case, which are really cool to see.
Especially if it's walking around and you're just seeing this, and Dave didn't even recognize it as being from planet Earth.
Yeah.
Can't fool PJ Leash. All right, the next one should be a little easier. Emily emailed us and asked about this insect. It is black. It's got wings. To me, it kind of looks like it would be a hornet, but Emmy hasn't seen it in their yard before this summer.
Okay, so this is a type of thread waisted wasp, and there's an entire family, the family Sphecidae, where they get the name because it looks like they have on a very narrow, like a corset almost. Their abdomen is reduced to kind of this very thin stalk. It's a really common family, lots of members in this group. To narrow down the species, I would have to see like a size reference and some other features. If it was quite large, we have one called the great black wasp, which maybe has a body length of about 1.5 inches to maybe 2-ish inches for a big one. Can be intimidating in size, but can actually be a very common pollinator this time of the year.
Ooh.
And there's some other ones that can be entirely black as well, like grass-carrying wasps, the genus Isodontia, and so on. So I can't tell the exact one, but it's definitely a thread-waisted wasp in this case.
And it's just it's a black wasp. It doesn't have any real color to it, but it also has what appears to be a cinch around the middle.
Yep. And it turns out, so folks often will see these, and maybe if they're large especially, be worried about stings.
Mm-hmm.
These sorts of wasps are solitary nesters. They don't have the colony of hundreds of relatives to defend, and because of that, they turn out to be pretty docile. You'd probably have to grab one barehanded before it would sting you. In this time of the year, July, August, September, they can actually be pretty good pollinators too. You'll often see them going to flowers for nectar, and they're going to do some pollination along the way.
Useful. So I can't stump you here, but I've got about a minute, PJ. Jane emailed us, and she wants to know what North American insects have become invasive elsewhere. We talk about invasive insects here. Can you name North American insects that have become invasive elsewhere?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on that one at the moment. I know there are some. With global trade, we have things that have gone from North America elsewhere. Here. Well, actually, one that does come to mind now, if you go back to era World War II, there are propaganda posters about it, calling it the Ami Kafer, the American beetle. This is Colorado potato beetle, which got to Europe and cause problems there, but that's a North American species. So that's one I can think of off the top of my head on short notice. There are others as well, and things from Europe and Asia have come here. So with
Colorado potato beetle.
Yeah,
can't stump you, PJ.
Global trade, things have gotten moved around.
And we certainly tried today, and we thank you for playing along. Always fascinating, always interesting to see the smallest little animals among us and how big a role they play for all of us. So thank you, PJ.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
Manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, PJ Leash, and thank you all for your questions, your pictures, and trying to stump our expert. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.